Welcome to the Moneyball Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Harry Glorikian. This series is all about the data-driven transformation of the healthcare and life sciences landscape. Each episode, we dive deep through one-on-one interviews with leaders in the new cost-conscious, value-based healthcare economy. We look at the challenges and opportunities they're facing and their predictions for the years to come. My next guest recently wrote a piece that made the statement, "The increasing specialization of medicine is compartmentalizing and fragmenting medical knowledge and creating a barrier between the different specialties, and that it's only by stepping back and looking at the bigger picture that we can spot some of the truly remarkable things that the general public and sometimes the medical community at large simply aren't aware of." Dr. Mark Boguski is the Chief Medical Officer of Liberty Biosecurity LLC and founded the Precision Medicine Network in 2014. He is a member of the U.S. National Academy of Medicine and a fellow of both the College of American Pathologists and the American College of Medical Informatics. Dr. Boguski has served on the faculties of the U.S. National Institute of Health, the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine, and Harvard Medical School, and as an executive in the biotechnology and pharmaceutical industries. He is the former vice president and global head of genome and protein sciences at Novartis, and a graduate of the medical scientist training program at the University of Washington in St. Louis. He has also written a series of books on cancer for the general public under the series title Reimagining Cancer. Mark, welcome to the Moneyball Medicine Podcast.
It's a pleasure to be here, Harry.
So, Mark, I was reading that statement, and when I hear a statement like that, that I read at the top of the show, I step back and I think systems biology, not necessarily disparate pieces. And so it seems like over time, if I go back to doctors, you know, they'd look at the patient as a whole, and now it looks like we're looking at them in pieces.
It's actually worse than that. You know, when I was in medical school, we actually did physical rounds on the patient, on the patients on our floor. You know, we'd go around to the bedside and examine every one of them. Today, people do rounds in a conference room sitting in front of their laptops, and there's actually less patient interaction than there used to be.
You also say, like, it doesn't stop there. By looking at the bigger picture and not confining ourselves to disciplinary boundaries, we'll be able to make connections between different fields of medicine and glean information that isn't taught yet in medical schools, gaining insights that have the potential to transform medicine. And when I hear that, I think, again, systems biology, but how data is going to help us reassemble the parts, because there's so much detail in each part.
So let's start with oncology, because considering revolutionizing all of healthcare is just too big a bite to take. Example that of interdisciplinary interaction that you mentioned plays out in something called a tumor board, or the multidisciplinary tumor board, where all of the subspecialties are represented: the medical oncologist, the surgical oncologist, the radiation oncologist, cancergenic counselors, advanced practice nurses, radiologists. They all come together to discuss a case. And that's where the multidisciplinary input occurs. The problem is they only happen once a week or maybe twice a month, and that's not helping individual patients in real time. So there's something we've been working on in conjunction with Dr. Mike LaPosada at the University of Texas Galveston called the Diagnostic Management Team. And I see this team as an integrator of the various data inputs from different specialties, where a group comes together and reaches a consensus interpretation of all these data streams coming in to affect one patient at a time.
Well, that was going to be one of my comments, and I had put together a piece on this on my blog. But is it time to just, when I think about corporate worlds, we used to always joke that when there was a reorg, the CEO had read some book or something, and now we're reorging around it. But I don't know if I've ever seen a reorg in medicine based on where technology is going. And are we at the point where, let's take oncology, do we need to reorganize oncology? Do we need to forget about the organ per se? I mean, I don't want to take it away from the surgical oncologist because they need to understand that organ and actually work on it. But the treating oncologist, I mean, we're doing basket studies, we're looking at pathways, we're understanding how drugs perturb a pathway, you know, that has nothing to do with the where the it is in the body. And I feel like if we look at AIDS and we played whack-a-mole and now we understand how to beat it back, oncology is sort of following in the same footsteps of once you perturbed two, maybe three pathways, you've sort of cut off the lifeblood of whatever this, you know, mistake that's happening in the body is going on. Are we at the point of organizations or institutions need to really rethink how they do this for the benefit of patients?
Absolutely we are. As an aside, before I come back to describing the situation in more detail, I'll tell you the biggest problem is change management. It's getting people to behave in ways that they weren't trained to, they're not comfortable with, and may take some extra time initially for them to learn. And this diagnostic management team concept is one of those things that people will have to be motivated to adopt. So with respect to to oncology, when I was at Novartis back in 2005-2007, there were only a handful, less than five targeted therapies. The first one dates back to the late 1990s. It was Herceptin. The second one was Gleevec, which was approved around 2001-2002. But even then, we foresaw a day when the FDA would approve drugs not based on the organ system in which the tumor originated, but the underlying molecular pathway. So let's say that was back in 2006 that we thought that would eventually happen. It's actually taken until 2017 for that actually to happen. There was a drug, pembrolizumab, that had previously been indicated for melanoma, but was finally indicated for any tumor of any tissue origin that had DNA mismatch repair as its molecular genotype and phenotype. So the biggest challenge in oncology and is really educating the up-and-coming oncologists and pathologists to think in a systems way, to think in terms of pathways, not organ systems.
But I look at it two ways. One is, do we need to rethink med school from that perspective? Because there's data streams coming from everywhere now. The other thing is, let's face it, if the institution you go into, like the corporation, is structured a certain way, you file into the structure and it's so if you had a computer science group or a data analytics group that was associated with the treating oncologist and you know Atul Booth said, you know, if you're not using genomics in oncology today, it's like driving at night without headlights, wouldn't that force the specialty to go down a certain road? And I'm assuming we would see a benefit towards patients.
So here's the deal. When I listened to Barrett Rollins' podcast, which was excellent, I think he kind of left out one thing. And that is when you talk to the head of an NCI cancer center, they only treat about 10 or 15% of cancer patients in the U.S. So if you really want to have an impact, you want to get to that what I call the 80% market, which is private practice or group practice oncology in community hospitals and regional health systems. And the reason I bring that up is because not long ago, I was talking to the president of a major oncology group with 1,500 oncologists in an allied group of practices all over the country. And according to him, about 2/3 of his oncologists never heard of DNA, you know, don't really want to learn about it. And they're thinking of retiring early because they can't understand, you know, the subject matter.
But that's crazy. I mean, that's insane. I mean, I think about that. I hear that all the time. And it absolutely just floors me because I think to myself, the patient is getting the incredible short end of the stick, right? We always talk about healthcare costs going up. Well, if you're not treating them the right way, of you know, I would think that, of course, you're not, you know, healthcare costs will go up because you're not getting the best outcome. What do we need to do to turn the ship faster?
So what you have to realize is that these docs who don't really know about DNA, we're never trained in it. I mean, you know, a generation ago or half a generation ago, genomics didn't really exist. The typical training of an oncology fellow, or even going back to medical school, not everyone was a specialist in genomics or immunology. Now the dominant science in oncology is genomics and immuno-oncology, and the practitioners, particularly those outside academic medical centers, just simply don't have the background to understand what these tests can provide. And so we identified, the major gap is really an educational one. They need tools and hopefully on a mobile platform that they can consult in real time and not have to take extra time out of their day to go and read, 25 papers in the literature. They have fingertip access to the latest knowledge about biomarkers and pathways, et cetera. And over time, as they use such a tool over and over again, that will help educate them to take advantage of some of these modern diagnostics.
Well, I always think to myself, if we think about the super consolidation that's been happening in medicine over the past, say, since the Affordable Care Act has come into play, we're not talking about the one, two little hospitals that are sitting out there. They're big conglomerates, for lack of a better term. I would think they would be able to create an internal group that would then assist or read out to everybody out there. Think of it like a central HR group in a sense. But I want to step back and so we've known each other for a long time. What are you doing these days? What are you focused on at Liberty, and just give us a little bit of background there.
Sure. Well, Liberty Biosecurity is a company that views the biggest threats to human health in the 21st century as biological threats. And these can be man-made biological threats or simply the result of shifting ecosystems as a consequence of climate change, or they can just be really hard medical problems that no one else has cracked yet. So we brought together a multidisciplinary group of people who are connected in a way that we're only sort of one node away from anyone that we can that we need to help solve a problem. So we're working on two major things now. I'll describe oncology first, because one of the reasons that it's hard to innovate in oncology is people try to do it in the United States, where there's a lot of legacy institutions, legacy standard of care. It's very, very difficult to innovate in a system that's already running a certain way. So we're actually helping the government of Thailand, and one of the largest companies in Thailand, kind of reinvent medicine. We call it skipping the landline. It's pretty obvious what that metaphor means, but we're trying to, in conjunction with the government, which has this concept of Thailand 4.0, that concept involves changing the economy from an industrial economy to a smart economy and skipping the landline in the process. So we're helping set up several advanced cancer research centers at existing hospitals, and these will be dry runs or trials or pilot projects that will eventually be incorporated into a new physical institution called CP Medical Center, which is due to open in about 4.5 years.
If I gave you a whiteboard right now and you were to redraw oncology, how would you redraw it? How would you incorporate genomics, digital pathology, image analysis? How would you just walk through that quickly?
Well, it's interesting because in the design of this new hospital, they really have to think about how to juxtapose different departments and divisions. And so we have a greenfield situation here where we can help them put together things that were separate that belong together in sort of the transformation of oncology. So you want radiology to be right next to pathology because these are the two diagnostic specialties. And 60-70% of clinical decisions are made on data that comes out of the pathology lab. So I think Eric Topol is the first person who really called this out explicitly. But I would combine radiology and pathology into a new specialty called RadPath, in which their primary job is to synthesize data streams into a report that can be used by the clinicians. So that's one of the things I would do. I would also transform tumor boards into more frequent real-time diagnostic management team meetings that meet more frequently, that meet in time to make a therapeutic decision at the time when one is being made. And those are two of the things that we will be experimenting with in this Thailand 4.0 CP Medical Center.
I'm always thinking that when you analyze an image and utilize the machine learning or artificial intelligence or all the different methodologies necessarily that are out there today, I think the systems do an amazing job of seeing things that a person might not be able to see. When I was interviewing Massimo Buscemi in one of the podcasts, he was saying they've come up with a way of having the pixel sort of look at each neighboring pixel, and you can see a blockage in an artery when it's not visible to the naked eye. The machine can actually look at images that aren't necessarily easily visible to a human eye. So we get a processed image, whereas the machine can look at raw data. Where do you see that sort of capability going, and is it going to advance what we're doing in the medical area?
So I'm a pathologist by training, so I'll signal that bias up front. But as you've said in the introduction, I do take a more systems view of medicine because I've not only been a pathologist in my career, I've been in genomics, bioinformatics, I've been in the biotech sector, I've been in the pharma sector, and I've seen the problem from many different angles. So getting back to pathology, pathology has been criticized for not adopting digital technologies sooner, and they're often compared with radiology, who adopted them, you know, almost overnight. You know, the problem between the two fields is that with pathology, you still have to remove something from the body and process it in a laboratory before you can digitize it. So the savings that you realize from not having, in radiology, not having film libraries and chemical tanks to develop X-ray film, that changed the economy of radiology. It's harder to do in pathology, and so pathologists have been slower to adopt it, and also because pathology departments, although 60-70% of clinical decisions are made on their output, they tend to be viewed as cost centers in their health system, not profit centers. And so everything, you know, if you look at the C-suite, they want every test to be as cheap as a complete blood count or a urinalysis. And with genomics and digital pathology, whole slide imaging, you know, that's not what it costs. So people have to retool and recapitalize their equipment in order to fully realize the value of digital pathology. But as you said, once that's done, we can use it to augment humans by pre-processing the slides and pointing out suspicious areas that pathologists need to put their human eye on. We can also use it to spot things that a human pathologist might not spot. Let me express that a different way. So one of the diagnostic modalities for predicting the efficacy of immuno-oncology drugs is the body's immune response to the tumor. Now, that's done right now with anti-PD-L1 antibodies, just a brown stain on a regular microscope slide. In a DNA setting, it's done with tumor mutational burden. But both of these things are really surrogate markers for a lymphocytic infiltrate in the tumor. And pathologists don't normally have the time to manually count all the lymphocytes associated with a tumor. A computer can do that in 2 seconds. And, you know, just imagine being able to replace expensive, time-consuming, long turnaround time tests with just an AI or machine learning application on a $2 H&E microscope slide. So that's where part of the potential really makes sense.
Yep, and I think in some ways it would help standardize the process, right? You and I both know you go from institution to institution, you will get a different answer depending on who's looking down the barrel of that scope.
Absolutely right.
So, you know, interestingly enough, I was also reading sort of, you know, there was a paper presented at the 2018 Machine Learning for Healthcare Conference at Stanford University where, you know, MIT Media Lab researchers, so we're not even talking about, you know, university hospital or something like that, but MIT Media Lab researchers detailed a model that could change the dosing regimes to be less toxic, specifically in glioblastoma, with a self-learning technique where the model sort of iteratively adjust dosages, eventually finding an optimal treatment path with the lowest possible potency and frequency of doses that should still reduce the tumor size to a, you know, degree comparable with traditional regimes. And you know, they showed that this seems to be working quite well. How do you see something like that being incorporated in this practice of oncology? Because it seems that technology, when applied across a number of areas, should have a probability of increasing outcomes, yet decreasing cost over time. I understand that there's going to be an initial bite to take all this on, but it's just like anything else we do in corporate America. You got to spend it up front and then you realize the savings on the back end.
Right. That's why you have to take a systems view of the healthcare system or an individual hospital system. Again, each department is either a profit center or a cost center, and that's not a holistic view of the value that the diagnostic laboratory supplies. Getting back to more directly answer your question, I think one thing that's never mentioned, you know, people talk about the DNA-driven data transformation of oncology, but one of the nuances that is seldom mentioned is the combinatorics of therapy. So let me give you an example. They're both targeted therapies and immunotherapies for melanoma and lung cancer and many other solid tumors. In fact, for melanoma, there are six different targeted drugs you can try, and there are two immunotherapies you can try, or you can try some combination. So where computers are really necessary in figuring out the best combinatorial possibility given an individual patient or a patient avatar that looks like that patient. So back in the day when there were only six targeted drugs, you could figure that out in your head. And
right.
You know, today there's about 115 targeted drugs or immunotherapies. We're going tissue agnostic. What the heck do you do with the combinatorics of that kind of pharmaceutical armamentarium you have in front of you now?
Oh, I remember. I could almost, when all this first started, you could keep up with the papers. I can't possibly even try. So if you didn't have a system to help you in some way, I don't know how you would manage between the gene, the drug, all the other details around a patient, and how do you keep that straight? I don't know how you would practice what you practice. It would be like, you know, flying a plane without all the other instrumentation around you.
Yeah, so this is the missing link in oncology and pathology training now. It's training our future oncologists and pathologists to think in systems biology ways, to teach them enough about combinatorics so they apply those principles to what's coming out of AIs and machine learning algorithms, and have the ability to synthesize them based on at least some understanding of the underlying technologies that lead to these data streams.
So what do you think the changes are that we need to make in institutions today to get the, I don't want to say the biggest bang for the buck, but for lack of a better term, it is a business. But at the same time, we need to be looking at patients, right? And I always try and tell people that talk to me about oncology issues that they have is always remember that the person on the other end of this, yes, they want your best interest, but it is still a business. So there's sort of interesting ways to look at that. Where do you believe that this is going?
Well, I'll answer that by first saying that that I'm not a businessman, but I know enough about business that when young people who are thinking about or developing new technologies come to me for advice, or small companies ask me what they can do to get their methodology or their technology incorporated into the workflow of physicians, I said, you're aiming at the wrong target. You've got to develop a value proposition for the C-suite. Not just think that that oncologists are going to adopt this, because again, there's two challenges. It's how to support it from a revenue point of view, and the change management. It's getting them things to do differently. So it's really dual targets for introducing new technologies and new operating systems and new standard of care. It has to make sense to the C-suite. It has to make sense to the practitioners, and it's that combination, I think, that you have to convince to adopt a new way of doing things.
So just shifting gears for one, I'm not actually shifting gears, and we're moving it up the pathway in a sense, is how do you feel about liquid biopsies as the next generation of where we're going with this, as opposed to actually looking at the tumor? I know right now it's approved for treatment monitoring, right? Because we knew there was a tumor, right? But I'm thinking about, how do you think about it from a treatment monitoring perspective? But then ultimately, there's no reason why we couldn't see something before it actually happens.
So I'm very excited about liquid biopsies. I think there's a lot of work to do yet before they become routine for cancer care. But I think about them this way. The standard of care now, in terms of clinical practice and sort of FDA approval, is imaging. You treat a patient with a drug, you do some sort of radiologic study to show that the drug is working, and you often monitor response to therapy that shows visually that the tumor is shrinking. What if you could replace all of that expensive technology and logistics with a simple blood draw and get the answer in a couple of days, rather than have your radiology exam scheduled a month or 3 weeks in advance? So that's one thing. There's a cost benefit ratio to the conceiving of replacing radiologic imaging with liquid biopsy. The other thing, it could be much cheaper. It's not yet, but cost, turnaround time, and the ability to detect the presence of a tumor before it's even visible by radiology is another big potential advantage. In fact, I know one little company that can actually has a technology that you can tell from the DNA sample collected from the blood which tissue the mutations are likely to be coming from. That's exciting technology too, because it can direct your attention to where you might want to concentrate the imaging resources.
Well, I keep thinking about these technologies will also can also cause a complete shift in the business model. In other words, I could go to CVS and with one of these non-phlebotomist oriented technologies, draw blood, ship it off, have it done, and now instead of the patient driving 50 to 100 miles in some cases to an institution, it's everybody could be sort of monitored on a regular basis.
That's particularly intriguing, given the work that we're doing in Thailand, because the CP Group owns the 7-Eleven brand for Asia. And, they're thinking holistically about this, monitoring patients in the community without having them come into the hospital, and have an expensive, time-consuming radiology scan, when they might be able to just drop into their local retail pharmacy and have the test done there.
Well, that's when I think about CVS and Aetna. I mean, if you go into the hospital, they sort of lose, right? Because now they have to pay. Whereas if they're able to sort of monitor you or keep you healthier at their local CVS, they change the economics of this. And so, you know, telemedicine is the other area where something happens or they see something at a CVS. Well, the doc can technically be right there. They don't need to be at an institution. So it's interesting how this whole shift is happening from technology-enabled medicine. And I know that's heresy and the worlds we're used to, where we come from, but you see it, how technology has affected everything else. And so I think, you know, we're at the cusp of a revolutionary shift. Now, whether the institutions can shift as quickly is the part that worries me the most.
Well, again, it gets back to innovating in the U.S. So many things are ingrained in our healthcare system that it's very difficult to innovate in any one step of the process when it affects upstream and downstream activities as well as the economics of it. And again, that's why this opportunity to work with the government and a major company in Thailand gives us a better shot at changing things over the next 4 to 5 years because they're motivated to become a smart economy, skip the landline, and go right into some of these new clinical and business models that you're describing.
It's interesting. I wish we could do that here, but I don't think that's going to happen anytime soon, except from external forces like Aetna, CVS, Walgreens, and, you know, maybe Humana or any of these other groups that are coming together, or maybe Apple, Amazon, or these other different groups that are out there. I know you had listened to a couple of the earlier podcasts on precision medicine, and you had said to me, you know, a few things were missing. What's burning? What did we leave out that we should have put in there?
Well, there's a lack of organized training for the next generation of oncologists and pathologists into this new way of thinking. Now, eventually, by generational turnover and things like that, oncologists will begin thinking in more of a systems biology, tissue agnostic manner. Again, anatomy will always be important for surgical oncologists and radiation oncologists. So we don't want to ignore them because their therapies are anatomically directed. But more and more of medical oncology is going to be tissue agnostic, and we're simply not training our residents and fellows in this way of thinking. They're still being trained in a fairly traditional manner.
It's interesting. Well, I mean, I always think when Kaiser announced they were going to open their own medical system, now this was post Affordable Care Act because they could see that things were moving to a value-based as opposed to fee-for-service. Do you think we need more medical schools along those lines to really get us to where we're going?
Yes, I do. And the reason is that, again, even in medical schools that want to do this, there's a lot of tradition. You know, it's the professor teaching, you know, his or her subspecialty, and there's not as much opportunity to integrate in a systems biology mindset in those traditional teaching models. I know Harvard Medical School teaches their curriculum based on system biology now, but not every medical school has adopted that yet. So I think it will take some new medical schools that train in some rudiments of computer science and statistics in order for the practitioners not to become, you know, the AI specialist, but simply to understand where those data come from, so they can trust the data coming from human augmented machines.
Well, it's interesting, right? If you think that physicians will also be measured based on performance and outcome, just like regular corporate America, right? That they're going to want to go to institutions that give them the tools to be the best, not just go to school per se, but become even more choosy than they already are about where they attend school to be able to be the best at what they do.
So how do you do that marketing and communication? You know, that's another challenge. You know, it's change management and marketing and communication. These two things are often ignored or downplayed when you're trying to change a system. People tend to focus on the technology and the bleeding edge science. but they don't consider the mundane aspects of how do you get the message out and how do you manage change among established practitioners.
Well, it's interesting, right? When I look at a company and think about strategy, the first thing I look at is the age of the management team. And I don't mean to generalize, but as a rule of thumb, I think, are they over 55 or under 55? And if they're over 55, it's generally what you see as a mentality of TTR, time to retirement, right? And do I shift or do I just make sure that nothing screws up along the way? And if it's under 50, right, then I actually almost have to do something because I'm going to be around for a while. So I have to actually make some fundamental shift or put my mark on it. And so, again, not to generalize, because I know, you know, people like you and others that are on the bleeding edge of change. But I think that those, you guys might be the exception as opposed to the norm.
Well, I'm a big believer in neuroplasticity, and I think anyone at any stage and age in their career can learn this stuff, but they haven't had the tools to teach themselves, and I think that's been one of the missing links or big gaps in the way people think about this. They never think about how you're going to market, communicate, and provide tools in order for the people who want to learn to be able to readily learn.
Well, some people are very comfortable with change. Right. And some people are not comfortable with change at all, as we all know. So is there anything else that you thought was a missing portion in some of the areas that we talked about?
No, I think we've pretty well covered it. I mean, again, the missing link is education and training, both at the early career level, but also in terms of continuing medical education. And I think the other big challenge is focusing on convincing the C-suite that this is going to either reduce costs or improve patient outcomes or both. And it's convincing the physicians and the C-suite executives as both groups in order to get change really enacted.
Mark, thanks so much. It was great having you on the show, and look forward to hearing how the Thailand experiment works out.
Well, let's get together again in 6 months to a year, and I'll let you know.
Okay, excellent. Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's it for this episode. Hope you enjoyed the insights and discussion. For more information, please feel free to go to www.glorikian.com. Hope you join us next time. Until then, farewell.